said, Sarah, excuse me, when I entered the Army, back up just a bit, I was in my junior year at the University of Toledo when Pearl Harbor came along on December 7th, 1941. And I finished the semester out in early February, after the semester was over. I enlisted in the Army, and I was sent down to Camp Leach in Louisiana. And I had basic training with the 28th Infantry Division. And then I happened to spot some paratroopers in Columbus, Georgia on a weekend pass, and they looked like the best troopers and soldiers that I'd ever laid eyes on. So I decided that, well, that would be the outfit that I wanted to be in. And in the meantime, when I was with the 28th Infantry Division, I had completed basic training, and I qualified for possible officer training. So I went down to Fort Kennedy and went through officer training school. And what we were, Sarah, we were called 90-day wonders. 90 days, 3 months, we were commissioned as second lieutenants. And shortly after that is when I volunteered for the paratroopers. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned to the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division. And we trained in about a year, in 1943, in the States on problems and exercises. And then we went overseas in March or April of 1943 to England. And there in England, we trained almost up to D-Day, which was in June of 1944. And we had practice jumps and we had problems that we were assigned as a unit. And then on June 6, 1944, and if you want to take a look here, Sarah, we were in a marshaling area, and this picture here was taken on June 5th, the day before these troops, myself included, jumped into Normandy about 1:30 in the morning. It was still dark out, and that was about 4.5 hours before the beach assault forces hit Omaha and Utah Beach. A number of these people here, K.A. Beatty, he was our executive officer, and then several other officers were here, and this is me, believe it or not, right there. And I'll never forget, Sarah, when Churchill came along, he was a dour-looking old gentleman, and General Eisenhower, came along, and he looked me right in the eye, and he winked, and he said, in a whisper almost, "Good luck, soldier," and I've never forgotten it. And I guess that rubbed off on me because I'm here, mm-hmm. You see. I survived. Uh-huh. We had a lot of casualties. We lost an awful, awful lot of men because, you see, I don't know how much do you know about combat troops, Sarah?
Not very much.
Well, first-line combat troops, right, paratroopers, we're dropped behind lines. Come here, Maggie. There we are. I'll sit. We're dropped behind lines, and that's what, behind the German lines. Mm-hmm. So, naturally, we sustained a rate of casualties. And I was in Charlie Company, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division. And, I was wounded. You asked me if I was injured. I was wounded severely, D+3 in Normandy. I was shot through the chest.
Is that what D+3 in the chest? D+3, what's that?
That was the third day into Normandy after D-Day. D-Day was June 6th, and that would have been the 9th. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, I was evacuated back to the hospital in England, and recuperated for about 6 weeks. And I could have had a lesser assignment because of my injury, but I fought real hard to go back to my
company. You chose to go back?
Because, you see, I was single and young, and my company, my buddies, were my family at that point in time. And I couldn't picture myself anywhere except back with my old comrades, Charlie Company. that's where I went. And then we trained in England. In the meantime, I should say, the 82nd and 101st Airborne that we were pulled back in July, taken out of Normandy, pulled from the units that suffered many, many casualties. So we were pulled out of Normandy and came back to England to get replacement troops that refitted and get arms and supplies and get ready for our next mission, because being in the paratroops, the airborne units, we weren't, the theory was that we weren't supposed to all the time. We went in on special missions and behind the lines and established beachheads, you might say, into enemy territory, but then once that was done, we were pulled back out to go on the next mission, which was called airborne missions. So at any rate, do you want me to go on in this vein now? At any rate, that brings us up to approximately early September. And then we were assigned another mission to make a parachute jump, a combat jump into Holland, the Netherlands. And that occurred the 17th of September, 1944. But unlike Normandy, where we jumped in about 1:30 in the morning, where it was pitch black, pitch dark, we jumped in broad daylight, early in the afternoon. And that was related to the mission was the plan. And we assembled, and we were about a mile and a half from our objective, which was on a bridge on the Wilhelmina Canal, mm-hmm. which was north of a place called Eindhoven. And when we got up to the bridge, this was within an hour or less of dropping in the drop zone on the DZ. DZ is a drop zone. And being daylight, we were able to assemble. And it was a pretty much surprise operation. We had a lot of backfire from the German gun emplacements in the air, but all in all, we were able to assemble quickly, and we then double timed up to this bridge to take it. The Germans blew up in our faces. Wow. So at any rate, we were able to get across the river, and the engineers came up and put a bridge across. We got the bulk of our troops across. Then it was continuous fighting in Holland. For several months. And there's all kinds of things that I can tell you, like details, but suffice it to say that we lost an awful lot of men. October 6, 1944. It is one date that will live with me the rest of my life, because in that date, our regiment was ordered to fight through a town called Ophusen and take it back from the Germans. It was house-to-house combat, house-to-house fighting. And the Germans, we went in, that had already been in combat. We lost men up to this point in time, but on that particular date, 1st Battalion, my battalion, which C Company was a part of, Charlie Company, we were doing hand-to-hand, house-to-house fighting through this little town of Ophir. And we came under an 88 barrage. We went into, I might say this, that we took Charlie Company going into this Ophir operation. Was controlled. It had 118 men left and 6 officers.
How many did you start with?
About 168 men and 8 officers. At the end of the day in Ophusen, I get those figures. I was there. Remember them. I said 118 men and Charlie Company and 6 officers tonight. But at the end of that day, Sarah, I was the only officer left. I had 26 men in my company. That was all that was Charlie. And we were pulled out in the 326th 7th Rider Infantry Division. They came in and we pulled back, rolled late in the evening, dark. We went back about 1,500 yards where we understood that it was back in the lines. And we went into a little orchard, and the whole battalion was less than 100 men. Well, a battalion is usually around between 500 and 600 men. That's how badly decimated that we were. People find that hard to believe right now today. Well, sir, the next morning at the crack of dawn, we had a German machine gun opened up in an orchard across the field from us. And you could always tell a German machine gun because of the rapid fire, the rapid sequence of firing that they had in contrast to the American machine gun, which had a slower rate of fire. And, okay. Our battalion commander, Colonel LaPrade, who was later played in Bastion, was a West Pointer, young West Pointer, he was young colonel. He came up to me and he said, "Hazensaw, see, I have been a platoon leader up to this point." He says, "Hazensaw, you're the company commander." The company commander is 26 men. But anyway, he says, "I want you to take your company and do a left flank movement around and get those scouts in the orchard." Now, at this point, no one knew how many Germans were in this orchard, you see.
I'm going in there blind.
Well, he said, "I'll give you 81 millimeter mortar support." And I'm thinking to myself, boy, you don't know how many scouts you can have. No one did, but we knew they were there. So anyway, I went and took my men through a ditch at an angle to the orchard, and I had a sergeant, he was a Mexican boy, his name was Sanchez, Sergeant Sanchez. He was also killed up in Bastogne a few months later. You see, Sarah, I remember these names, and I can't remember my own name sometimes, but I'll never forget these names as long as I live. Sergeant Sanchez had eyes like a beagle. You could see a fly on a fence post 50 yards away, almost. But anyway, I said, "Sanchez, you call that 81 millimeter mortar fire into the woods. And when we lit the fire, we rush the woods. My 26 men, okay?" Mm-hmm. So he did. And Sarah, he, with his eyes and his good grasp of the situation, I tried to get an award for him, and I did later on. Sergeant Sanchez walked that 81 mortar fire in steps through the orchard, and we could see the explosion from the orchard, and we could hear the crowds in there screaming, "Bloody murder," it was right on. So, and the mortars lifted, we rushed across the road, not knowing how many people were in this orchard, and Gerald S. Forshee, my scout, and I was the second man back of the scout because we led our troops in those days. We didn't stand way back in the airborne. We led our men. Mm-hmm. Right up there back of the scouts. Some people say that's not good to do, but we did it. At any rate, of course he was killed on the road. And immediately after that, of course he was killed, my scout. The Germans came out of the woods with their hands up. We were in utter consternation on our part, on my part, and we formed these troops up. Only 26 guys I had. See, I keep repeating that to you, so you know. We took just over 150 prisoners, and they counted over 55 dead crowds in the orchard. So we disarmed them. We disarmed the Germans on the road. And I remember Colonel LaPrade coming up a ditch, trying to take cover in the ditch and going very low. And he came up and he saw how many prisoners that Charlie Company, composed of 26 men, had taken. He was just, you can see it in his face. He just couldn't believe it, you see. And that's probably one of the crowning moments of my military career is that particular. So anyway, we went through the rest of Holland. We had patrols, I can give you all kinds of stories, but my time doesn't permit you. I took a patrol out one time, a reconnaissance patrol, and it was usually three men, with myself and two of my troops, charged on the missions after our week, after the fight to Orchard. And anyway, we got up to a railroad embankment with double railroad tracks on top. It's about 1,000 yards from my own line. This is pretty much a static position. And the salient that we had, the salient union, thrust up into enemy territory. Never got any further than that. It stayed that way for the rest of the war. But anyway, I had this patrol up, and I had, I was on my stomach, and I had a submachine gun. And I crawled across these railroad tracks, and I had one man on each side of me to the rear. And the crowds would come out at night, man points along this railroad track. And we had taken a compass reading. We knew where these machine gun emplacements where the two crowds would come out, man at night. So we shot an azimuth for that compass, and we shot it between two points that we were aware of that they had already established and would come out at night and land. But I had the darndest luck, so to speak, when I got up to the railroad track. A visiting crowd patrol was going between the two points, and I don't know how many crowds were there, but we could see the bucket helmets bobbing up and down as they walked along the other side of this embankment. Wow. So I had shifted my Tommy gun forward, and these crowds came up, and I fired, and he wasn't probably over 36 inches away from me, face to face. And then the crowds back to him opened fire with automatic weapons. And each one of my men grabbed one of my legs and just literally yanked me back and down the embankment on our side. And we were lucky to get back to our own line. Now, recon patrol was shot for that night because the whole line was wide awake then. But the funny part of it was, Sarah, when we got back to the lines, I went to the company CP of B Company, where we went out, and a fellow named Bill Reed. Bill Reed was a good friend of mine. He was company commander, and he was later wounded when he was laid through the bed out in Castroon. But anyway, Bill looked at me, and I was in his group, some candles that he had in the CP back of the line, just back in the line. And he said, "My God, Alex, what happened to you?" And I said, "I don't know, what are you talking about?" Anyway, one of those automatic bursts had raised a big, bloody blister on my lip. That's about as close as you can come, Sarah. Let's take a break here. Late November of that year, I'm still in 1944 now, we were pulled out of Holland, and we went back to France. Ormeron, France was the name of the place, the old French army fort and barracks, to get replacements. To get resupplied and to get replacement men in to fill up badly decimated ranks that we had, both the 101st and 82nd Airborne Division. So we were in Morlaan, France about 2 or 3 weeks. And it was kind of a fun time in those years. We got 3-day passes to Paris. Mm-hmm. We had great times in Paris, I'll tell you. Yes, indeed. But anyway, about the mid-December, the Germans started an offensive in the Ardennes, which is an area in Belgium adjacent to the German border. So, this offensive, when it started, was completely unlooked for, and our American intelligence had no indication that it was going to happen, so it was a complete surprise by the German military. And they just rolled our troops back over areas that had been fought over months before. So the only really reserve combat troops that Eisenhower had at the time, General Eisenhower, was the 82nd and the 101st Airborne Division down in the Mormelon, southern France area, or mid-France, southern France. So anyway, we were alerted one day on the 15th of December. We'd only been there for a couple of weeks or so, 3 weeks at the most, getting replacements and getting men and getting equipment and so on. And we were not completely outfitted yet. So we got orders to get ready to move out that same night.
How many replacements did you receive for your company?
I don't remember, but not enough. Yeah. We were under strength. But anyway, that same night, we got on the trucks, open semi-trucks, and we drove all that night and went to a place called Bastogne, Belgium. And we got off on the western edge of Bastogne, which is just a very small town, it was then. And I'll never forget, Sarah, how American troops were just running to the rear, and almost in panic, and many of them were panicked. And they had dropped their weapons along the way. They didn't have, most of them didn't have weapons. Now these are troops that had been online from the German system with their tanks and
artillery. And they were pushing them back?
Pushing back, yeah. So we got our 1st Battalion, my battalion, got orders immediately on getting into Bastogne. Colonel LePratt had orders to take the battalion through the town and go through a little place called Foy. There's a picture taken of Foy. It was just a crossroads that was taken after the action was over. To a place called Noville. Noville, and that was about 5 miles east of Bastogne. So the 1st Battalion then went through the town, and I remember this. This might be of interest to you, Sarah. We were so slow there. We had not enough ammunition, and the 10th Armored Division that was up there in Bastogne at the time were stripping the 30 caliber machine gun belts of cartridges and handing us handfuls of cartridges to load our clips for our M1 rifles. And we were going into an attack in a very short time. So anyway, that was how close this whole operation was. So anyway, I'm going to shorten this up for you. The long and the short of it is that we got into Noville, and we immediately went into an attack, and our company commanders had received, they went on a reconnaissance just a little bit before, and they knew just where to place our troops. And we went in with limited ammunition, M1 rifles, light machine guns, and a few bazookas to reinforce a battalion of tanks, maybe 10 armies that were already in Noville.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Krauts, the Germans had a weapon called the 88, you heard me mention it before. Mm-hmm. The 88s were on their tanks, and their Tiger tanks and their Panther tanks. And that weapon, that 88 cannon, was far superior to anything that we had. So it would blast an M4 tank, or a tank destroyer, an American tank destroyer, the smithereens. And half the time, our 76-millimeter cannon wouldn't even penetrate a Tiger tank. And old-timers knew this. So anyway, the tank, we were attacking high ground to the northeast of Noville. And when these tanks opened up on us, we had no alternative but to pull back to the town. And we put up a perimeter defense around Noville. And all that afternoon, sit on Maggie, that's cool. All that afternoon and all through the night, we held those death winter events. Tanks had come up and fired down the street into the buildings where we were. And we had a few that took around and we did that stuff. But we did hold the lines. The infantry tried to, the German infantry tried to break through this, but we couldn't do it. And we had orders from the division to hold Noville. Don't retreat. To hold it at all costs. Just stay right there. And I never thought, sir, that I'd ever live through that. I thought, well, this again, the Hazen's Hall and Charlie Company and all the rest of my buddies, because I didn't think we'd ever get out of Noville alive. So late in the morning the following day, we did get orders from the division that we could fight our way back to Noville, which was halfway between Bascom and Noville, to Foy, and back to our lines. When we got to Foy, we did that. We got to Foy, we hit an awful strong trout roadblock. That roadblock was something else. We lost a lot of men there. Several stories there. And we finally got through that little block and back into Bastogne, where we lost an awful lot of men. And then that, we were all cut up. So we went into reserve, and the very next day, while the Germans had penetrated our lines, and A Company and C Company from the 1st Battalion combed some woods to try and drive those Germans back. And just about that same time, sir, is when the skies opened up and it started to get cold. The temperature went down and down and down, and the snows came. It turned out that that was the worst winter in the Ardennes for 100 years. And it was so bitterly cold, I never ever thought with the time that it would ever be warm again.
Did you ever get frostbitten?
Oh, yeah. You know, not me. I was fortunate, but a lot of our men did get frostbitten and have their hands and their fingers frozen, their feet were frozen, because we went into this action, just to say again, with hardly any preparation, you see, and very little supplies, very little ammunition, very little of anything.
You guys didn't have winter supplies? Did you have winter supplies?
Not then, we did later on, but that was the other thing. We had leather, there's a miniature pair of paratroop boots.
Mm-hmm.
Dutchman, an old friend of mine, gave it to me years ago. He's dead now, but this was made in Holland by a shoemaker, a custom mm-hmm. shoemaker. That's the way paratroop boots used to look.
So very thin.
But they're leather. They're not designed for snow and mm-hmm. cold weather. Anyway, we survived somehow, and General Patton broke through to us around Christmas time. And we the skies opened up, and our C-47s could resupply us. When they tried to many times, the C-47s come over, but the fog would roll in, and there was no visibility, so they couldn't pinpoint their drops through. If they did drop something, the crowds would just as likely get it as we would, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a miserable situation. And I'll tell you something, Sarah. I appreciate the life that I have available to me all these years. When I was dictating something, and I've got some tapes here that I've made an extensive mm-hmm. Dictating. I unless someone lived in the cold foxhole or with not at inadequate clothing and the cold sub-zero all the time, you can't imagine how miserable a human being can be. And to have what I have today, a nice warm home, nice family, I had a fairly good business career, and I've enjoyed the fruits of it since I retired. And when I think of all my buddies that are still over here, they never had that chance. Down into southern France, and the spring came along, and the Germans were pretty well defeated by this time. We ended up the war in Berchtesgaden, Hitler's Bird's Nest, and we were the first troops in there. And I have some interesting things from Berchtesgaden. I sent my mother home some little pieces of china, dressed in china, as a matter of fact, which I guess is among the world's finest, right from Hitler's bird's nest. And would you like to see them?
Sure.
Yes. Been that long, yeah. Sarah, that piece matches. That's a demitasse cup, and this is a little egg cup that soft-boiled egg would go in there, you know? And did you ever see that before?
No, I never saw one of those.